He is about to win his eighth stage at the Tour de France since he won at Verdun back in 1993. This will be the greatest win because it's Alpe d'Huez, the mecca of world cycling. That's the bend that Greg LeMond once almost overshot as he was riding to win the Tour de France. Now are we seeing the foundations of the man who will win the Tour for the third time in Paris? Lance Armstrong will probably say, yes, you are. 6 hours and 23 minutes. He had to bridge a six-minute gap to win the stage. He has given us a tremendous demonstration. Yes, that's the one I wanted, and I've got it.
Welcome to another episode of How to Be a Texan. How do you like talking about fallen legends today, Kevin?
Oh, man. A fallen legend?
A fallen legend. Just like a fallen angel. Lance Armstrong, he's a fallen Texans legend.
A fallen angel.
I don't know. Is that too harsh, or we just say he's a Texas legend?
I think it's too harsh. I think he's a...
I think it's a little too harsh, too.
Yeah. He's a Texas legend.
We've never claimed somebody as a fallen legend, but...
I don't think we've done that on this episode yet.
Boy, I tell you. Well, Lance is on the bubble, if nothing else. Most people would say he's a fallen legend, but we can give him some credit. Let's talk about the do's and don'ts of, or the pros and cons of Lance's career and life, and then we can circle back to whether he's fallen or he's truly a Texas legend.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. Do you like that clip we started with?
I love that guy. I love that commentator. It's just almost kind of soothing when I hear that guy talk. So great.
It's like comfort food.
It is.
It is. I love his voice. I wish I had that kind of accent.
I do too. Now that's even an exciting part of that. Most of the time, like when I'm watching the Tour de France, it is truly like comfort food because he just kind of describes the scene and the beautiful mountains they're going through and, you know, the gyrations of the peloton and how this group's out front by a minute and 20 seconds. But don't worry, the peloton will catch them in about 20 minutes. It's no big deal. And, oh, by the way, they're going up an 18% grade right now for the next 8 kilometers. And you're just like, it's just amazing watching that guy.
It's great. It's like you're on a vacation through the countryside of France.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Like you're in a tour, bro. You know, the scenery is so good. You see these little villages, and then you got that guy's voice in the background. It's really awesome.
It is awesome. And they've gotten so good at filming it. You know, I was watching some of Lance's early races, and the filming of it was just terrible, you know. And now you've got helicopters that are over the peloton. You've got the motorcycle riders going backwards with these no-bounce cameras, and it's pretty amazing just the scenery nowadays, what they're catching.
Yeah,
and who knows what
cool
they'll
stuff.
Do with drones and, you know, whatever else. It'll be even better. So
True. Well, that clip was from the 2003 Tour de France, and that was a historic one, and that's the one where Jan Ullrich, who was, you know, they were kind of rivals over the years, Lance and Jan, in the Tour. And in 2003, in that particular one, you know, Lance Armstrong... You know, they're cruising along, they're racing. They were halfway up that climb on that particular mountain, and Armstrong's handlebar got caught in a spectator's yellow, like, flag or scarf or whatever they were raising, you know, or waving in the air. You know, they have those fans just lined up along the side, you know, at certain parts of it. And so they're climbing up, and this fan's waving this thing, and Armstrong's handlebar gets caught in it, and he fell. He actually fell down.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that was a great moment where Ullrich could have just, like, you know, blown him away and left him in the dust. But in cycling, you know, there's a great deal of sportsmanship and honor, right? And you don't want to win in a... you know, not legitimate way, right? And so Ullrich actually stopped and waited for Armstrong to not only get up, but also to get caught back up to the group, right?
Wow.
Yeah, so imagine, you know, Ulrich and this, you know, group kind of slowing down, you know, letting their fallen competitor get up, because it wasn't his fault.
Yeah.
Catch up, back up to the group, and then they start racing.
Yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, you know, Armstrong attacked him and took off and ended up, you know, winning that stage. Jeez. And he won the tour that year. So it's kind of a cool story. And I love the sportsmanship of it and just the honor.
I do too.
You know, that's associated with it. And just the thought of, you know, I don't want to win unless I really, you know, legitimately truly win it. Yeah.
I got to
beat
this guy. I don't want to beat him because somebody just yanked his handlebar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, so that was back in 03, you know, in these day and age, I mean, who knows? But that was really cool.
I don't know. There, you still might see it in the tour still. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a big
wreck
this year.
Yeah, in cycling, I think you would. Yeah,
I think you would, too. You know, you saw that crazy big wreck this year, which was ridiculous. There was a woman with a sign that just jumped out, basically, on kind of the right side of the peloton, and caused this massive pileup behind her. And she was looking at the camera that was filming the peloton coming at them. And she jumped out, flipped her sign out, and basically caused, I don't know, it was probably 50 riders that crashed. And sure enough, a lot of them caught back up to the peloton, which was good. Some of them were injured and were out for that day. So anyway, but hey, today I thought we'd talk about Lance Armstrong in all genuineness. You know, he was a full hero of Texas, and then, you know, he was disgraced because, you know, he was caught cheating. But that's something that you and I'll talk about too, about how widespread was that, and just how unbelievably difficult that race is to the human body, the Tour de France. And But I want to talk about kind of his early career. You know, he was born and raised he was born in Richardson, Texas at Methodist Hospital on September 18, 1971. So he's basically our age, a couple years younger than us.
Yep.
Lived in Plano. He was in the swim club. He became a triathlete, a pro triathlete at the age of 16, and he was really ranked number one in Texas for 19 and under, but he was pro at 16. And so he was just an unbelievable athlete, you know, as a youngster. And now he did finish, he tried out for the 96 Olympic time trials, and he got six there. So, no, I'm sorry. He actually made it to the Olympics and made it six. So he didn't medal, but still pretty good in 96 as a young man. And then, so that's his early career. So he's just this unbelievable, just stud athlete, you know, and grew up around North Texas. And then he really focused on cycling. And that's when he joined, you know, the U.S. Postal Discovery Team. And right as he was getting into his pro career, he was diagnosed with cancer. And so this was around October of 1996. Where right after the Olympics, so he starts his pro cycling career, was diagnosed with cancer of the lymph nodes, brain, lungs, abdomen, and testicles.
And stage three.
So
which is super advanced. It was bad.
It's super advanced. So yeah, they gave him a 10-20% chance of living through this. So
think about that spread.
Yeah.
Think about that spread. I mean, usually, you know, once it hits, and you're in the healthcare industry, it hits your lymph nodes, you're pretty much toast at that point because it goes everywhere, right?
Yeah. You would. Well, I mean, think about it. Yeah. Lymph nodes, brain, lungs.
Brain, lungs, and abdomen. I mean.
And yeah.
Yeah.
That's all over the place. And so. Yeah. He went through chemo in December of 96. They removed a testicle that had died. It's kind of gross, but it had died because, I don't know, the chemo or the cancer or something. But so he had that work. So this is all in December 96. And then he literally showed up in January, a month later, January of 97, for a 100-kilometer practice ride with a team.
That's crazy.
And they said he's 100% cancer-free.
That is crazy.
Yeah. So, and that was February 97 when they, so he went to a practice ride in late January, and then February they said, he's cancer free. You're good to go.
Okay. So wait a second. So he was initially diagnosed in October of 96.
Yep. Did all the treatments, the chemo in December. Doing a practice ride.
So basically that fall.
Yeah. He was out.
And then he was already back by January of 97.
Yeah, literally a month later. I mean, who does that? Who gets chemo?
So he did 3 months with all that cancer and then like, okay, I'm back on the bike.
Yeah,
that's insane.
I'm good. Yeah. And you and I know a 62-mile bike ride is no piece of cake.
No.
And he just did that for a practice ride and then it's like, yeah, okay, I'm good. Rub some dirt
that's
on
crazy.
It. Let's go.
That's
so,
nuts.
I mean, that alone is, in my mind, kind of heroic that you just went through that and then, oh, I'll just get on my bike and ride 62 miles with some pals.
Yeah, well, it just shows his physical fitness and
he was a monster.
Heart. And, yeah, he was not. He was of another planet almost.
Well, he was. And then I watched, just recently, leading up to this, I watched some of his practice rides and his work ethic. You know, he worked harder than anybody. And so he would go and practice for hours and hours and hours on a ride just so that he could get a feel for it. And I saw one where they're like, Lance, there's like 9 meters of snow deep up ahead. We can't get through it. And he's just riding and looking at them. And he's like, ah, we can get through it. And so he just keeps going. I'm like, 9 meters of snow is like, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, we know that, you know, there was 1 centimeter of snow, and I tried to get you to ride, and you're like, no, I'm out. We're going to
No,
die.
I don't.
You
I'm
told
a Texas
that story
guy.
Recently.
I don't do that. I don't. But apparently Lance can ride through 9 meters of snow. And
that's
and he
insane.
Did. I mean, he just was like, well, he was all bundled up, but he was riding, and he'd been riding for 5 or 6 hours up this mountain, and they said, well, it's too snowy ahead, but he's like, well, let's keep going. And they just kept going. So anyway, he was always a really, really hard worker. So then getting into his pro career, you know, what he's known for is the Tour de France wins. He won that 7 times, and he won that from 1999 through 2005. And so he won that with multiple teams. And so the way pro cycling goes is, you know, these fantastic riders will be with somebody for a year or two or three, and then they'll flip over to another team. So he started with Motorola. Then he moved to U.S. Postal and the Discovery team. Then he moved to the Astana team. And then he moved to Team Radio Shack. And throughout all that, you know, he had fantastic, wonderful, top-tier cyclists that were with him. And he was with some, like Jan Ulrich and some others. Those were the studs on the teams that he got onto. And he played second fiddle to Jan Ulrich for a while as he kind of led into that. And then he took, you know, he took the spot in the highlight, you know, or in the kind of the alpha role on the team, and then he ended up winning. And those teams are so important. So when you watch the Tour de France, you see the importance of those teams. About how they position, how they have sprinters, how they have mountain climbers, how they really protect the lead rider. They'll create a cushion around, and then they'll, like, you know, jump out in front, and Lance will get on the wheel of, you know, his team so that they can pull him through, so then he can kind of explode at the end for the win for that stage. It's just amazing to watch. I remember when all this was going on watching this, and it was amazing watching him and his team and how dominant they were just time after time. And not just in the entire race, which is grueling, you know, a month of, you know, these 100-mile bike rides up and down these mountains all through the Alps. But he also was a phenomenal time trial rider too. So he would win stages where he would just kill it on these time trials. And that's not really what he was known for, but he was just such an amazing athlete. He could do it. He could be a mountain climber. He could be a sprinter. And he could just, you know, for the long haul, he was just crazy good.
Yeah. So, no, just to correct one thing there, him and Jan were not on the same teams.
They weren't. I thought they were on the early team.
No, they were on different teams. And that's why they were competing with each other, right? Because, you know, if you were on the same team, then you have a team strategy and pretty much, you know.
I could have sworn that first U.S. Postal. But anyway, I'm sure I'm
they, right. You know what? They may have been back then, yeah. On the 2003 is what I was looking at from the clip.
No. This is
that's when they were on.
They split up because I remember watching a video where Lance literally was just another dude and Jan was the stud and they all
protected on the same
Jan.
Team.
Yeah, and this is well before Lance started. You know, this probably was in 97, 98 before Lance really rose to that level where he was going to be the winner.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, and then in those prime years, they were on different teams and they were competing, you know, against each other.
Yeah.
For those titles, which was really cool.
Okay, so
the team aspect of it is really cool.
It is cool.
And, you know, when we first started riding, I didn't, you know, realize how much having, you know, riding with other people or having a Peloton or having somebody pull for you, you don't really understand how much it really adds until you really do it, you know?
No, I didn't understand the physics of it, but it's stinking amazing. So if y'all
it is.
Ever,
it makes a huge difference.
They literally just pull you on, and you're like, "I don't think I'll pedal for a while," and the Peloton literally just pulls you like down the road at a huge velocity. You and I did one race where I remember we got in. It was a ride. You know, it was a 2-day ride, 150 miles, which was phenomenal. But you and I jumped in with this group of these just giant, strong, big fellas. There's about 20 of them, and we're like, "Hey guys, you mind if we jump in?" They're like, "Whatever." And so we jumped on, and we got on the back of them, and
never done that before. I remember that was the end. That was end of day two on the MS-150, and we were both just exhausted, and we had never done that really, and we're like, "What the heck? Let's jump." There's probably about a dozen of those guys, and they were doing a single line thing, and we just kind of hopped on the back, and they weren't really, you know, it was towards the end, so they weren't really rotating. So like one dude like pulled everybody, I think
it was like the bull.
And so we just kind of hung on the back of those guys, and at the end of like we were like, "Oh, I think we're onto something there."
we don't really have to work hard.
We're gonna go back and teach all our friends how to do
so
that.
So they can pull us.
That's right.
I don't know. There's something about the physics there of just the, it just sucks you along. Mm-hmm, and so that's why, you know, again, it's important to have a good team so that you can actually rest. You think, okay, well, how am I going to rest while I'm riding 100 miles up a mountain? Well, you can if somebody's kind of in front of you pulling you. Anyway, so pretty
well,
amazing.
Well, and you know, what's even more interesting than the team pulling is like in these competitive events, you can watch them and, you know, you'll see a guy kind of get behind another dude. Right. Mm-hmm. And just like get on his wheel. And that guy's not intending to pull him. Right. Because they may be racing each other. But, you know, he'll get on his wheel and he'll kind of ride on his wheel and draft on there for a while and let that other guy get worn out, and then he'll do what they call an attack, which is then say, "Okay, yeah, thanks for, you know, wearing yourself out and letting me get my energy," and then just kind of take off and, you know, blow pine and just leave them in the dust. So that's another really interesting, you know, use of that same technique. It's really cool.
Right.
It's really cool.
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember, but, you know, back during the height of Lance's popularity, you know, he was like Tiger Woods, Tom Brady, you know, he was everywhere on all these endorsements during the height of all of his wins. And at the time he had a net worth of around $125 million, where he was just raking it in. He had this amazing bike shop down in Austin. I don't know if you remember ever going down there. I know I did.
Mellow Johnny's.
Yeah.
Mellow Johnny's. Which is a play on the way the French say yellow jersey. It sounds kind of like Mellow Johnny or something. And so he literally did the Texas Mellow Johnny.
That's great.
And named it after that French phrase there.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. Well, it was a great store. I still have a hat from there. You know, it's just awesome to go to. Well, anyway.
There's a coffee shop attached to that. I've never actually been there, believe it or not. There's a coffee shop attached to it. And the name of that shop, I need to try to look it up and find it. I'll find the exact pronunciation of it. But it's also a play on words. And it's either French or Spanish. It sounds like a really cool name. But it's actually either French or Spanish for one ball. Which is kind of a...
Yeah,
he did that because of the testicle removal surgery, and so that's attached to that's attached to the Melogiani, bicycle shop there in Austin.
Oh man, that's great. Yeah. Well,
I'll look up the name, the exact pronunciation.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into kind of the scandal. So he won those seven tours, which nobody had ever done.
Here it is. Here's the name, Juan Pelota.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Pelota.
Juan Pelota. So Pelota means ball, and then Juan is kind of a play on the word, one. So Juan Pelota Coffee Shop.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, that's funny.
How funny is that? At least you got to have a sense of humor about it, you know?
Well, you got to have a sense of humor. That's right. So let's get into the scandal. So it had never been done, winning seven tours in a row. His arch nemesis, Floyd Landis, won the next year and was stripped of that title because of doping allegations. So several years later, in 2010, Floyd Landis basically said, okay, fine, I did it, but everybody did it, including that guy, Lance Armstrong. And so that started up this, huge investigation. And, for a long time, Lance denied all of the scandal, the doping, the blood doping, the EPO, et cetera. And so, then you remember on Oprah, he came out and he's like, yeah, okay, I did it. Here's all that I did, and here's the implications, and here's exactly how it worked.
Oh, he did that on Oprah.
He did it on Oprah. Yeah, he did it on Oprah. So, it was a big deal, but it was years and years of him going to the government and saying, we didn't. I didn't do any of that. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. And then he's like, on Oprah, finally, the pressure was so great that he's like, I'm coming clean.
The pressure of Oprah was much, much greater than the government.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know why he decided to do it on Oprah, but he did. It was just like a tell-all. Oh, and I remember the interview. I remember watching it going, holy crap, he is spilling his guts on Oprah. And he did.
Well, one interesting thing. So when Landis lost his title for the 2006, they gave his title to the next guy, some guy, Oscar Pereiro or whatever.
All right.
But when Lance lost his titles, they did not give them to anyone else.
Wow.
They took them away, but they did not give them to anyone else.
Yeah.
So if you look at the history of all the winners of the Tour de France, that period of, 99 through 05, when he won all those are all... They basically just show no winner.
Just vacated.
It's just vacant. Yeah.
Wow. That's powerful.
In some ways is like, I wouldn't say it's necessarily honoring him, but maybe it's a little bit of, recognizing that that is still an incredible feat, even though you may have been doing, performance enhancing drugs.
Right.
Because probably everybody else was too,
Yeah. Well, that's the common thought, is that he was not alone. Now he and his team may have figured it out better than others, but most likely he wasn't the only team out there that was doing what he was doing. So let's talk about that. So what exactly was he doing to cheat? And so I looked at two or three different studies on this, and it's actually quite interesting. So what happens, again, during that month of riding, you are destroying your body. There is no way the human body can stay healthy during that time of when you are just abusing and breaking the muscles down. There's nothing you can do to to keep your body healthy through that just debilitating, horrific, you know, torture on your body. There's just no way you can do it. So what they figured out was, well, we've got to find a way to get more oxygen to the muscles so that they can regenerate and stay healthy for performance. And so how do we get more oxygen to all the muscles and all the organs in the body? Well, you do it two different ways. They may have been doing it more, but the two that I understood were the blood doping and the EPO. And so the blood doping was, so these cyclists, they would spend the entire year leading up to the Tour de France. And so you're planning for it all year round. So if and it just happened. I mean, it literally just, is this still going right now?
No, it's done.
It just finished? Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe he, you know, 3, 4, 5 months ago, he's taking blood out, healthy, good, strong, well-oxygenated blood. He's taking that out and freezing it or putting it in the fridge. And he gets that ready so that a third or a halfway through the tour, he's starting to, you know, transfuse that back into his body. And that's really the blood doping. So he gets this kind of shock of his own red blood cells that are carrying oxygen all throughout his body. So that's number one. Number two is this drug called EPO, which is, and they could take it throughout. It was illegal, but it wasn't found. All the lab tests that were done for blood specimens didn't identify EPO until after Lance got through winning in 2005. That's when EPO was found in all these blood tests. But EPO generates more red blood cells naturally through bone marrow. And so it basically is a stimulant to the inside your bones and your bone marrow to start producing massive amounts of red blood cells. Therefore, you've got a huge input of oxygen.
Yeah.
The third and final thing that I found was that they were doing these slow-release testosterone patches. And so think about it, Kevin, like if you and I, if we're on a ride and you just get naturally kind of saggy and your energy level goes down and you're just done after 40, 50 miles. Well, you got these slow release testosterone patches that are just kind of springing you forward and bringing more and more energy levels to you than that, you know, it was yet another cheat. And yeah, he admitted to all that.
Yeah, no, that's crazy, man. You know, the oxygen, you know, your ability to convert, you know, oxygen to, you know, to get it to your muscles.
Yeah.
Right. And then to also get that CO2 out of your system, the more efficient, right. Because as you ride more and get more in shape, you get more efficient at that. Right. And, you know, so just then jacking yourself up with even more red blood cells just takes it to a whole new level. Right. So, which came first, though, the EPO or the blood doping? Was EPO first, and then when they figured out, they started to do the blood doping to try to get around it?
I think actually the blood doping was, that's a super old school trick where you're basically infusing your own blood back into your body. That's an old, old school trick because I'm putting my blood back into my body, so who's to know? It's just really healthy, super oxygenated my good blood back, you know, a few months ago when I'm laying around versus now where I'm completely depleted. So my guess would be it was such an old school trick that they just said, oh, we can get through all the cheating screens to do that. And then EPO, I would think, came along as well. So
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's it. And then, you know, I saw some other stuff just on kind of how, again, kind of what a mega athlete he was. There's all kinds of lactate levels and thresholds that normal humans are here. And then, you know, Lance was up here as far as his ability to kind of endure pain and just stay at a super high level. The same study was talking about Michael Phelps, you know, having that same kind of ability to perform at a high level, whereas most humans just don't have, you know, that God-given ability. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, you know, when you're doing that cycling and I guess any other kind of sport, but, you know, I studied this with the cycling that we were doing. you know, the lactic acid is a waste product of that oxygen, you know, processing in your muscles, right? So, you know, it's a waste product, and so that's why over time you go out and ride for 5-6 hours. You know, if you eventually cramp up, what's causing the cramp is the buildup of lactic acid in that muscle, and that's what causes it to cramp, right?
Right.
But the more you get in shape, the more your body learns to process that more and kind of move it out. So that makes total sense. If he was like this, you know, freak of nature that could just blow through and never be bothered by lactic acid buildup, I mean, he could just, you know, like power through and ride forever. It makes total sense.
The way they described it was that at certain levels, you just get so much pain that you just can't move through the pain. He had such a high level that he moved, he just kept going, and his pain threshold must have been ridiculously high as well.
That's crazy.
Crazy. So, you know, again, he admitted to it. The question is, how widespread was it? You know, the thought is it was extremely widespread. So was he cheating? Yes. Was it a scandal? Yes. Were others doing it? Yes. So were others getting caught? Probably not. But he did, and he admitted to it. So he was stripped of his titles. But, you know, one other thing I wanted to just mention was, you know, his foundation that he put together that, again, is very noble. You know, after his fight with cancer, he developed this Live Strong foundation. It was really popular back in the day. Everybody had the Live Strong, you know, rubber, you know, armbands that everybody wore around. And I remember that. I think I had one for years. And it was really around cancer survivorship. And that was just so important to him that we fund that. We fund cancer research. We fund families of those living with cancer, you know, victims and survivors. And it was a powerful foundation that he put together. Now, if you look at it, it's still a very powerful, you know, with a incredible mission, and it's run by an independent board now. So I don't know how much he has to do with it other than being its founder and originator, but it still goes on, you know, as far as the Live Strong Foundation, and they fund a lot of pretty tremendous things around cancer survivorship. So
yeah, well, it's I think that's pretty noble. Even if he never did, you know, any of the titles or anything after that, just what he did to survive cancer in and of itself is just an incredible story, you know.
No, it's strong.
And just that should give hope to, you know, anyone that has it, that, you know, because his diagnosis was bleak. It was very, very, very bleak.
Yeah, yeah. And no, it was bleak. Now, let me ask you a trivia question. Do you know where Lance lives now? It's not in Argyle.
He didn't live in Austin?
No, he didn't live. you would think so, you know. But no, he apparently he lives up in Aspen. So.
Oh, really?
I think him and Costner are BFFs up in Aspen now. So.
Oh, okay. He probably just rides up there in the mountains. Is Aspen?
Yeah, probably listening to our podcast. So anyway, shout out to Lance. Oh, yeah,
they're regular listeners. He's been. I think so. Them and the Russians. On him. Yeah.
He's been
pinging us. Yeah, you guys need to do an episode on me.
Yeah, Texas Fallen Legend episode on me. Yeah, I'm just kidding. Okay, so let's circle back to that. So do we think Lance is a Texas legend or truly our first fallen legend?
I think he's a Texas legend. You know, I think he got caught up in something that, you know, caused him to, you know, lose his titles. But like I said, they didn't really give them to anybody else. And, you know, and you can't deny... I mean, if you really have ever done cycling or, you know, any kind of sport like that, you just really can't, you know, even if you stripped away all the drug, he's just a phenomenal athlete and competitor. Phenomenal. And, you know, I just think I have to respect that, you know.
No, I'm with you. So definitely scandal involved, but that dude, man, what a stinking awesome athlete. So I'm with you. Mm-hmm, we'll chalk him up as a Texas legend. So. All right, Kevin. Yep, well, I appreciate you visiting with me about Lance Armstrong today.
Well, I do have one more story before we wrap it up here.
Oh, you got a story? I love story time.
Well, you know, we've always done, and I haven't ridden a bike in like 20 years, but you know, back in the day, we used to ride a lot. And so I've got a touching story, you know, very similar to the Jan and Lance story that I told earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was out riding with my buddy Chris one time through Argyle, and I started cramping up. I was dead. I was bonking out, and I had this pickle. You know, we would carry pickle juice with us, right? Because that would kind of rejuvenate you on the ride. So we're going up this hill in Argyle, and like, I can't even drink my pickle juice. I drop it on the ground. That's how bad I was. I couldn't even hold the pickle. So I like stop on this uphill slope, and I'm picking up, you know, and this is where Chris just kind of, instead of blowing me into the dust, he came back and rode circles around me as I was picking up the pickle juice. And then once I got it, he just kind of looked me in the eyes and he said, I guess you forgot your pink purse that you usually carry your pickle juice in. And then he just took off and left me in the dust.
Pink purse or your pickle juice?
Oh, man. I guess you forgot your pink purse that you usually carry that pickle juice in. And then he was gone. It was awesome.
Well, that certainly sounds like Chris.
So that's our touching, you know, cycling competitive.
Well that is touching. That story. Is touching.
It's very
touching.
We've ingested. So pickle juice is our EPO, I guess, because it.
It is. Yeah.
Well, it is. Yeah. It really, it's crazy. So you think, my gosh, why are you freaks drinking pickle juice? Well, it's got tremendous salt in it, and that just,
You start cramping up, take a little pickle juice, man, you're like, it rejuvenates you.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's a huge help.
And shout out to our buddy Chris, you know.
Chris and Lance. There you go.
If Lance was as good of an athlete as Chris, he might have won a few more titles. But
a few more. Know. Didn't need all that stuff.
More. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks for listening to us today. Appreciate it.
Yep. Look us up. Leave us a review. Like, share. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, yada, yada, yada.
Yada, adios. Yada, bye. Yada. See ya.